Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. Kate Lee makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. Most of you, if not all of you, know well who she is, but I'll introduce her briefly. Kate Lee is an award-winning journalist who has covered politics and social affairs in Australia and the United States. She edited the Australian's Review of Books in 1997 and now writes for the Weekend Australian magazine. She's married with two children, lives in Melbourne, and her first novel, The Unexpected Elements of Love, was long listed for the Miles Franklin Literary Award, and of course Kate spoke at the Sydney Institute around the time of that book coming out, her first novel, and now here with her second novel, The Marriage Club. But tonight's topic, which Anne has chosen, is What's Wrong with Modern Marriage, Melbourne, and the Middle Class. Kate, you're very welcome.
When Anne's weekly email arrived promoting the topic of tonight's talk, What's Wrong with Modern Marriage, Melbourne and the Middle Class, one of my cheekier colleagues immediately shot back his riposte. Everyone knows what's wrong with Melbourne. We need a ruckman and a full forward. If, as Louis Naur wrote in the Weekend Australian last weekend, Sydney's having a nervous breakdown, well, Melbourne's been in therapy for years. Any city that has as its most famous export a man who dresses up as a woman is a very strange place indeed. As for the problems of modern marriage, you need look no further than the made-for-television deathbed saga of cardboard box magnate Richard Pratt. His long-suffering wife, Jean Pratt, thin-lipped stoicism, is emblematic of Melbourne's emphasis on appearances. If you think of Melbourne as the capital of style and sophistication, Jean reminds me of a very well-cut navy gabardine suit, while their Sydney rival, Sherry Lee Hitchcock, conjures up a synthetic pastel-coloured chiffon fluttering in the breeze. Jean stood firm, no public dummy spit. She gracefully found a way of accommodating her husband's extra-nuptial child. Life, or in this case death, carried on. School fees will be paid. The blue stone foundations of Pratt's philanthropy and his position in society tremored only momentarily. The really serious business of the ACCC investigation was a mere sideshow to the spectacle of his private life. But you can't call the Pratts middle class. Despite the bloated expansion of this demographic midriff, no one I know has a house the size of Raheem. Not even George and Lee Kremer, who are the couple at the centre of my novel, The Marriage Club. Now, I'm not going to talk tonight about my own middle class marriage, because my husband's declared a fatwa on the subject. However, if I hadn't married my husband, I wouldn't have written my book. Living in a house where the hallway sometimes seems like the fairway at the Royal Sydney Golf Club, and the luck required as you enter a room unannounced, narrowly missing the head of the five irons that swings full pelt through the air, gave me the glimmer of an idea. My husband's rogue indoor swing, which in one house we rented used to set the glass pendants on the ceiling chandelier tinkling wildly, set me thinking. I checked to see whether the golf club had been in any prior domestic homicides or manslaughter cases, or perhaps an attack of golf rage as a pair teed off on the 16th hole. But the only deaths involving a golf club had occurred with the intervention of lightning. So I had the makings of a plot, and plots can be a writer's curse. The American writer Anne Tyler often says that whenever she hands in a manuscript to her publisher, the publisher asks, "Does anything happen in this?" Well, things do happen in the marriage club, and I think of it as a sort of miniature domestic thriller. And as the plot unravels, so do the relationships within a tight circle of women friends who belong to a book club. And in particular, the secret lives of one couple, Leith and George Kremer, come unspun. I don't want to spoil the happenings for any potential readers here, but believe it or not, it won't be giving everything away to reveal that George kills his wife with his golf club. That still leaves open the question of his intent and many other mysteries besides. Novels spring from very different places. as David Maloof announces in Ransom, a primary school teacher reading a Homeric story. A memory, an overheard conversation, a scene that lingers in the mind, a fear, a preoccupation, a sickness, a single experience, or as in the case of my book, multiple sources that pluck away at the sinews of your being until you have to play them onto the page. One of the prompts for my story came from my exposure to a Melbourne middle-class marriage that went horribly wrong. In 2003, the former businessman Jamie Ramage murdered his wife Julie in the kitchen of their Baldwin home. The city was glued to the court case, and I was as fascinated as the next gossip. Much of what we knew, or what we thought we knew, holds true to everything Barry Humphreys loved to parody about Melbourne's white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant pretensions. Jamie Ramage lured his estranged wife Julie back to their English Tudor-styled house to look at the renovations he was ploughing ahead with in her absence. They argued, and then he killed her. After burying her in the Kinglake National Park, and I think it was a shallow grave, he drove back to Melbourne and, suitably punctual, kept his 3 p.m. appointment with a kitchen renovator to choose a slab of granite for the kitchen bench. Wealth and respectability made this tragedy sizzling. We only have his account of what happened between them, but tongues wagged as if we knew the both of them intimately. I've always been fascinated by relationships, and the most crimson of these, of course, are family ties. The playwright Sam Shepherd was once asked, why does he always write about family? What else is there, he replied. In my journalism, I've been drawn to the thought precincts of the family court, where couples come to haggle over money and property and, obviously, flesh and blood, often with spectacularly tragic results. Because I've chronicled several of these dramas, I frequently get calls from husband or wives reporting more trivial disputes as if their particular stalemate is news, headline presumably with the words, husband disputes wife's version of events. I have lived and worked at a time when private lives have become central to our public discourse. We do not yet have speed cameras mounted in brackets in our bedrooms, but the urge to tell and talk about what goes on there has gathered an unstoppable momentum over the last 20 years. When I left Canberra in the 1980s, I was part of a press gallery where no one would have dared stray too far into the then Prime Minister Bob Hawke's private life. And I arrived in Washington where the media was in absolute uproar over Democratic nomination candidate Gary Hart had been discovered with an adulterous affair on board a pleasure craft called Monkey Business. In a century when the geography of the world can be Google mapped, we have turned to the frontiers of psychology, personality and character, the topography of the mind and the heart. But despite a welter of privacy legislation, private lives have never been so public. But all this talk, all this white noise, doesn't necessarily make us any wiser to the truth, and that is the nub of my book. I don't know how many of you have read Barack Obama's memoir, Dreams of My Father, but in that book he travels to Kenya to meet his African relatives, and they sit around discussing the story of his grandfather's choice of bride in a society where marriages were arranged by the male elders. Once a groom paid the dowry, the chosen woman mustn't seem too eager. She pretends to refuse him, and that was all part of the ritual. One of Obama's cousins wondered aloud whether the newlyweds slept together on the first night, and the grandmother replied, "No one knows what goes on in a man's hut." Another member of the audience asked, "Why did the women put up with it?" And the elderly grandmother said, "If one is a fish, one does not try to fly, one swims with other fish. One only knows what one knows. Perhaps if I were young today, I would not have accepted these things. Perhaps I would only care about my feelings and falling in love. That's not the world I was raised in." So we are all, for the most part, creatures of the customs and fashions adopted by the society we live in and the families that nurtured us. The marriages in my novel were made 30 years ago. The women were not dragged to a hut by their hair after the men made good on offers of livestock. Nonetheless, some of these partners struck bargains that were influenced by the world they lived in. They swam with the fish, they didn't try to fly. And no one more so than the character of George Kremer, who had to survive in a conservative family and succeed in his father's profession. Family law, with its gable of respectability on the frontier of social change, offered him a halfway house. His choice of specialty was a limp slap at his father, Sir Arthur Kremer, a High Court judge, who thought the new jurisdiction soft and squishy, beside the ramrod discipline of commercial or constitutional practice. We meet George Cremer in his chambers, practising his short game with his favourite putter on a scrap of fake turf, before he gowns up to take his seat on the bench. And on this Monday morning, he's presiding over an appeal by a young father who wants to spend more time with his daughter. We observe George trying to peer inside the heart and the head of a 28-year-old man who is around the same age as George and Leith's youngest son. And the story in the novel entwines the life of this petitioner to the court, a man who has been shaped by an absent father, a deceased mother, and a very patchy experience of family, a reminder of why George and Leith stuck together through the thinnest of times. If you've seen my book or read reviews, you might be wondering whether we're talking about one and the same book. Isn't the marriage cover about the relationships of married women? Isn't it exceptionally pink, the colour of chick lit? Well, yes it is, but it also seeks to explore the story of a misunderstood man. A man who erected a wall between his two selves, much as Germany was once divided between East and West. George Cremer took Leith Davies to be his wife in a conservative Melbourne where marriage offered a sanctuary, a hearth, a home, a place where you could park behind a substantial grey stone fence in a solid suburb. He stuck with convention at the fork in his road. People get married for the oddest of reasons. They marry their mothers, they marry their fathers, they marry for security, upward mobility, they marry on the rebound, they marry because all their friends are getting married. One woman I interviewed once told me that she married because her mother hated the man she was dating and she wanted to prove her mother wrong. Bad move. She divorced within years. Mothers are mostly right. Barry Humphries thinks he chose his first wife because he hadn't wanted to become an undergraduate, a perpetual undergraduate, a member of the Fellowship of Plots. This may have been why I decided to get married, in both of his autobiographies, although it would be wrong to describe this impetuous and dramatic event as a decision, since at the time I did not feel as though I had much of a say in it. It was all rather sudden and unfair on both parties, but it did enable me to leave home. Marriages are rarely what they seem. Most of us behave ourselves in public. We edit appearances for our friends and family and random strangers, staying an argument while we collect a handful of coins for the Red Shield appeal door knocker who has interrupted an unholy conflagration on a Sunday afternoon. In the privacy of our home, in the intimate space of shared bedrooms, the opportunity for deceit and cover-up enables extraordinary concealment. Extramarital children, affairs, addictions to internet, porn, gambling, drugs, a first wife, bisexuality, mental illness, you can be ambushed at any time. When Leith dies suddenly, her secrets lie exposed. Left alone in the Victorian mansion that George Cremer shared with his wife and their two sons, who are now living interstate, he begins to conduct his own post-mortem, searching for objects his wife treasured, and through their absence he pieces together her state of mind and shriveled heart. Obama's grandmother is absolutely right. No one knows what goes on inside a marriage, sometimes not even those living it. In the May edition of the Australian Book Review, Rosaline Love, who is the wife of the late Harold Love, a professor of literature at Monash University, unpicks the secrets he took with him to the grave, secrets she stumbled across during the last weeks of his life. She sat caring for the man she'd been married to for over 30 years. His death from cancer was painful and slow, not sudden like Leith's, and although he had time to confess and come clean, he didn't. As he lay in palliative care, Rosaline became aware that he was being visited by a teenage boy strikingly like her husband. Her essay, written months after his death, describes being hit by the thought that slunk in sideways. I do not know the man who is my husband. I may have known the man he once was, perhaps, but I do not know the man he has become. So she goes on a quest within the walls of her house, searching for someone who was gone and will never come back. And she makes clever use of her husband's library, notably writings by Montaigne, the French philosopher, who valued reparation over the high price of keeping secrets. She writes, I embarked on a treasure hunt, finding first one thing and then another. The final discovery marks the end of the chase and the beginning of something new. By the time I made it, I knew what I was seeing. On top of a row of tall books, packed tightly so their tops nearly reached the shelf above, I found a sheet of A4 paper slid in, invisible to the casual glance. Two photos were printed on it, rather fuzzily. Two people posed in such a way to show their likeness. One is Harold, the other is his extranuptial son. This child was kept hidden from our family. He was a clandestine child. So postscript returns to the words of Montaigne to describe secrets and diseases of the soul. Those who hide their vice from others, he wrote, ordinarily hide it from themselves. Rose is an acquaintance of mine. We walk our dogs in the same park. She's older than me, her children are married, and she's got a set of grandchildren. She'd not told me the story until she'd read The Marriage Club, where the experience of George rifling through Leith's possessions in search of a woman who was gone mirrored her own. And I think it's true, as A.D. Hope once wrote about long-distance relationships, that we sometimes grow closer apart. Rose is having the last word on her husband's deceit. That is her revenge, or perhaps her right. In America, the lawyer and author Elizabeth Edwards is promoting her new book, Resilience, which is the story of her marriage to John Edwards, whose adultery was exposed on the eve of his bid to become the Democratic presidential nominee. She says she was motivated by the desire to leave her version of the truth for their children. She's dying from cancer, her life's been stung by multiple tragedies, including the loss of a child. The shadow of death gives people time to set the record straight. British laureate Ted Hughes took this path when he published a lifetime's poems about his wife, Sylvia Plath, as he faced death, answering everyone who filled in the gaps for themselves. His collection, Birthday Letters, each poem grimly wrought in his wife's memory, was another source for my interest in the public and private spheres, how we shape perceptions and how complicated the truth about a relationship can be. This is the book that Leith's Book Club meets to discuss in the opening chapters of The Marriage Club. Leith has done her research, of course, reading a volume of letters that Sylvia had penned to her mother, chronicling her rapture for Ted, their travels, their mutual struggle for literary success, and her desperation near the end when his affair tipped her over the edge. She's struck by the distance between Sylvia's chatty accounting of their marriage and the bitterness of Hugh's recall. In July 1956, Sylvia wrote to her mother of how she'd fallen to Spain, and I quote, "If only you could see me now, sitting in halter and shorts, seven stories high above the modern tooting city of Madrid, on our large private balcony, with gay blue and yellow tiles on the floor, pots of geraniums and ivy. Anyway, I have never felt so native to a country as I do to Spain." His poem about their sojourn is titled, "You Hated Spain." "Spain frightened you, Spain, where I felt at home. The blood raw light, the oiled anchovy faces, the African black edges to everything frightened you. Your schooling had somehow neglected Spain." Penguin, my publishers, asked the Hughes estate for permission to quote from a poem in Hughes' collection, but the executor refused permission on the grounds that my novel told the story of a man who had murdered his wife. So much has been written by Hughes and Plath and about them, but are we any wiser as to what went on between them? Here was a natural topic for Leith's book club to savour on the night of her death. Did Hughes kill his wife? Was he at fault? Did they love each other? Marion, one of Leith's friends, points to the poem that Hughes wrote 10 years after his wife's death, as he sat reading the pages of her diary. "It is only a story," he concludes. "Your story, my story." The discussion between the women that follows throws into relief the assumptions, the presumptions, the flimsy impressions that influence their view of George's culpability in the following days as each character pieces together the crime on their doorstep. One reviewer ticked me off for using the book club as a means of binding my female characters together. It was a cliche, they said. Another lamented that in leg land, kettles are boiled, cups of tea made, the quotidian details of life are unfurled. Well, book clubs are a peculiarly Melbourne phenomenon. It's a cold climate there and we read a lot. And during the post-war years, it was the forerunner of the Council for Adult Education, which used to box up books and freight them out by rail to provincial Victorian towns. In an age of virtual chat rooms, the idea of people meeting actually face-to-face in others' homes to discuss words on a printed page has the pattern of a Quaker prayer meeting. I love attending book clubs as an author because you hear your characters come alive as if they are people the readers know, puzzling over their motivation. Would Leith have done that? I don't think George was that sort of person. The Marriage Club's stirred discussion of revelations of secrets like the child hidden by Harold Love. There is talk, too, about the shades of discontent in relationships. One woman ventured that she guessed there'd be no point in writing about happy marriages. Bingo. I said. We are drawn to other people's emotional entanglements as we try and make sense of our own. It is an unscientific fact and a sweeping generalisation, both, to say that women talk in a way that men don't. One of my friends in Melbourne was cleaning up a cupboard recently, and she found cachets of letters from her first husband. We pored over their contents, the language, the words conceived in love, with darker resonances hinting at what was to come. Women tell each other things. Bombshells may be dropped in a quick conversation to arrange a movie date. Snippets are released like dandelion clocks on the sidelines of sporting events as women watch their children play, or as we lean over the hand basin in the interval of a theatre. Once a complete stranger who was sitting next to me in the theatre told me the story of her marriage. We sat waiting for the lights to move. I've forgotten the show, but I've never forgotten her story. I'm always amazed by what I hear, often forgetting to remind myself that this is only one side and a notoriously unreliable guide. And if there was ever an arena where the two participants can disagree diametrically over who said what, the sequence of events, as well as who let the butter out of the kitchen bench, it's a couple who live together. Journalism schools you and exposes you to sifting through the different recollections of eyewitnesses, often contradictory, their viewpoints depending on their proximity to the event they observed, their frame of mind, or the opinions they bring to bear. When Melbourne solicitor Brendan Keeler was shot by a violent man who was abusing his girlfriend, she tried to get into a cab at a city intersection as commuters swarmed around on their way to work. The descriptions of what happened by those who watched the shooting unfold from a tram window, an office block, a street curb are all a jumble. Some say Keeler was deliberate, intent on tackling the gunman. Others insist he had just turned to look at the commotion like everybody else, an unfortunate bystander on whom we bestow the laurel of hero in order to make sense of his death. Under suspicion after Leith's death, George tells the detective investigating the case that the truth is a wily slip of prey that neither of them could wrestle to the ground, even if she were to help them. What would she choose to say? The writer Blanche Dalfuge recently revealed how she and Bob Hawke had kept their affairs secret while she was writing his biography, a book that persuaded many kingmakers of his political substance. In her portrait, which was published over 20 years ago, she outed his drinking, which he'd dealt with publicly, but she glossed over the intimate details of his adultery, finessing the truth skillfully as she did the rounds, promoting her picture of a man on the cusp of political greatness. Last year, in her essay On Longing, she furnished another view of what ostensibly happened between them. She wrote how Hawke had threatened, as they'd lain in bed together, that divorce could cost Labor 3%. As a result of this calculation, he decided to stick with his wife Hazel. Then, towards the end of his prime ministership, Bob and Blanche reignited their affair under the cover of loyal friends and courtiers. Out of office, divorce was affordable. In relaunching a writing career that had fallen quiet since marrying Hawke, Dalfuge decided to reveal all. But how truthful has she been? What has she left out this time? His side, her side. His story, her story. Rich pickings for a novelist. We craft our profiles for public consumption, from Facebook to book clubs, we lift and tuck. When I was writing the acknowledgements to this book, I thanked my husband and our children for binding us together. My father read these lines and hurrah, sounds like a marriage is on the rocks, better change that. So I did. Instead, I thanked my husband, who I said was still swinging his golf club in the hallway, and one day might just get lucky. Next, my publisher at Penguin was on the phone. I'm a bit worried about that reference to your husband. It looks like your marriage is wobbling. I refused to buckle. Black humour has sustained our marriage. It's part of our shtick. The other day I heard the thud of his club as I entered the hallway. Life better not imitate fiction, I joked. He retorted wryly that my death from his wayward golf club would at least send book sales rocketing up. Loyalties which he would inherit. Twice lucky in love, I told him. That is too much to ask.
Now, Fiona Grundy's got copies of The Marriage Club and I think some copies of Kate's first novel as well. I'm sure Kate would be happy to sign them with an appropriate comment. Whatever that might be. So we come to questions and discussion. I normally lead off and I'm a bit... you can't be too revealing.
Very sensitive territory, particularly when you ask in the room, see, my husband's in Melbourne tonight. Could have talked.
Well, we did discuss beforehand that it apparently was your husband's idea that the tennis book should be written.
That's right.
But I didn't ask why.
And I was going to say...
Why do you think Greg might have thought that was a good idea? You come back and talk.
Well, I was going to say that I'm just glad I didn't write the script for the film My Year Without Sex. Perhaps it's one he could have written.
But not My Year Without Golf Clubs. Come back here and talk down the end of the room. Yeah.
Kate, you've really surprised me how good you are at being a novelist. And if you were in America, you'd be, you know, fated all over the place. But how much of the sort of stream of women writers from North America influence you? And I know you made a comment about Antala, but when I read you, I feel Antala. It's a different kind of experience. But it's a very clever way of weaving numerous threads, which is life itself, and then, you know, working towards some sort of thesis about life too. So what have been your influences? Who and what?
Well, I mean, I think it's always hard when people ask you what are the books that changed your life, because, you know, I'm such a literary tart that, I mean, I'm always open to reading anything, and I have loved those women writers. I mean, Anna Quinlan was is not such a great novelist, but she's certainly out there, and she was writing columns when I first went to Washington, and she actually gave me the idea for writing a more personal voice column in The Australian. You know, Carol Shields and Oates, all of those, Anne Beattie, women writing about, you know, contemporary lives. And, you know, people say, well, where does the research come in? Well, the research is in the lived experience and in the conversations that you hear all around you all the time, and particularly with a book about marriage, of course, because people are always talking about their relationships and women in particular. So those are the main American experiences. But I also love Cormac McCarthy and, you know, lots of very good... Richard Ford, Independence Day. I mean, Richard Yates, Revolutionary Road. I mean, there's a sad story. What a brilliant picture of marriage in that book, and yet he died an emphysemic alcoholic, feeling very much as though he was a failure, and of course now his oeuvre is being discovered. So perhaps if I meet that death with a golf club in 20 years' time, the young version of Kate Winslet will be starring in the movie. The beauty of the film.
I'm interested in the issue of secrets and the fact that there seems to be an assumption these days that secrets are a really bad thing, so honesty is everything. What's the book club's view on this? What are the women saying about the secrets that are revealed in these marriages and whether it makes sense sometimes to keep secrets?
Well, I mean, I think the transparency of marriages and of your private lives has been a good thing in many cases, because as D.H. Lawrence once said, I mean, families like the storehouse behind the front door. And if you think of domestic violence or abuse and some of the dreadful secrets, the really shocking secrets that are kept within families, I mean, it's fantastic that those have been exposed and people are, you know, encouraged to come forward and talk about them. But you're never going to change the way in which people operate. We're always going to be curious, we're always going to get into trouble, we're going to be devious and mischievous, and, you know, secrets are going to arise. Modern marriage, of course, is always based on the premise of good communication and that people are much better and more open at talking about these things. But the potential for technology to facilitate secrets is an extraordinary thing, and that is a new thing. And the flirtation which goes on with the use of the mobile phones and the SMSing, with people being able to have conversations that they don't have to have face-to-face, so they can say things that, you know, might lead to who knows what, has opened up a whole new, you know, avenue. And also, I think, the potential for technology to come and unsettle marriages, you know, because you can track down people who you might have married 20 years ago these days and start a conversation online that then leads to, you know, another secret unfolding. I don't think we'll ever change that. I guess it's just a way of being able to manage it and talk about it and try and resolve it. And I think too, you know, in the Pratt's case, I really admire the way they sort of stuck together. I mean, a marriage doesn't necessarily have to go unstuck, as you would know, because of a secret. You know, it can actually make it stronger for bringing it out into the open and dealing with it. And it's just part of that rich shared history that a relationship always has. And I think that's one of the strengths of a marriage. It's not all, you know, happy. I mean, I think it was Alain de Botton, the philosopher who came out of Sydney recently, who said that he believes only 2% of people ever really find true love or absorption in their work, and that in a weirdly perverse way, a slightly sort of grim view of marriage is very reassuring to the rest of us.
Yes. We had a few good laughs about the problems in marriage. Let me just ask you a more serious question, or, you know, make a comment of a serious situation. Especially nowadays, you know, from a man's point of view, especially nowadays, a lot of problems occur at work. You know, people are laid off, and maybe some men at a certain age become ill. I think one of the most important aspects of a marriage is the support of a woman she can give to a man to solve the problems. In other words, you know, and on TV you see quite a few cases where men, you know, lost an arm and had an accident and so on, and the woman just sticks to him, period. It doesn't matter what the problem is.
Okay. Well, marriage is an incredible institution, I think, that it survived the most amazing battery of revolutionary changes in our world. And yet it still survives as a, you know, chosen forum for young couples today. And if you do a survey in schools, 98% of people want to get married. And, you know, even gay couples want membership of the club. They want to be married too. It has survived. We have so few rituals in our lives that people want to make that public commitment. I have friends of mine who've been living together with three children, they've been together for 20 years, and they got married at Christmas time. And, you know, I think someone had actually said to Michael, well, what would you feel like if your daughter was with someone who wasn't going to marry her? And that really got him off to the jewellery shop. So, I mean, I think that marriage, you know, I think marriage and family, to me, are a very important thing, they're pillars of my life. And, you know, of course people should support each other, because if you haven't got someone's shoulder to cry on when you go home, really.
Yeah.
Or a friend or someone who can help out. Yeah. Sad affairs. Well, I'm standing as the family for this candidate. Leaving at Stephen Fielding.
In Melbourne, are there any marriages other than the middle class? Because what happens to, I mean, I saw Mr. Carl Williams recently, his potential girlfriend went off and married someone else, and Roberta came in. So you've got these kind. You've got this kind of. And what was that case? The Ramage.
Ramage case. So they were very middle class.
And then there was the famous. There was that famous case. But then, what about the other side out in the western suburbs of Mr. Williams
Well, this came up at one of the book clubs I was at recently, and their view was that, you know, it's all out there. It's the middle class who sort of like to try and pretend that everything's happy and everyone's managing, and that they're the ones that you can sort of make up the stories about, speculate about, and have to guess at. But, you know, that it's much in the western suburbs that everything's out on the streets, basically. But they probably don't have the financial comfort to be able to divorce, to leave, so they stick it out and stay together. And of course, this is what people have said, or counsellors have said, about the global financial crisis, that you're going to have people living separately under one roof, because divorce just isn't going to be feasible for so many people anymore. But look, there's always stories. We've got another wonderful court case going on in Melbourne at the moment, which I think is a western suburb variety, where just unbelievable things happening. The wife wouldn't let the husband do number two in the toilet on the weekend. You know, you have no end to what you can imagine about two people, what they do to each other in close quarters. I mean, there's no end to the things, the strangeness of the relationships between people.
Well, you've got to finish the story. I mean, he did strangle
her. And why wouldn't you?
Oh, I read Melbourne Press for this reason. I'm pretty sure.
It's a cold weather.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that Roberta, what's her second name now?
Williams.
Well, she's still Roberta Williams. That's pretty good. I'm sure she'll get a book offer from Louise Adler.
One of the other things about your book is that the woman's about to leave her husband. Mm. She's finally reached a point where she's, in her own mind, gone back over what she's been doing and realises that that isn't what she should be doing. And the golf club comes between her new freedom. To what extent today, we're all back on marriage, but they're also breaking down still, and this has got to do with the strength of women and their financial independence.
And the complications of life, you know, the stress. Yeah. I mean, I actually had to write a piece for Weekend Australian after I'd written the book on the problems that counsellors see coming through their doors, and they say that, you know, stress is an absolute killer, and, you know, just as we have more road rage, you also see sort of aggression happening in the corridors of the home. But I think that that still happens today. I mean, I know people who have been at home, stayed at home to raise the children, and the loss of confidence that sometimes can come from being on the outer, and then, you know, in that awful transition phase, which is what happens in a long-distance marriage, once the children leave home and become independent and suddenly who needs you anymore, and having to deal with that, you know, it can be enormously challenging. And I think that, you know, to some extent, I too thought, is this going to be credible, that Leith has actually delayed and deferred this for however long, 28 years. But, and I'm now in that position where some of my friends are reflecting that sort of anxiety because of the path they chose. And I guess that's also what the book is exploring, is the disappointment and regret of the way life turns out and looking back and imagining how it might have been.
Yes?
Just on the marriage,
you
know, the daughter's going to fail, of course, right from the beginning. So I'm just wondering, do you think she knew that? Because he was having an affair with her, or
But she didn't know that at the time until much later.
Do you really think she didn't know?
Well, I think people, it's like, as Montaigne said, people who keep secrets hide them from themselves. And I think she probably hid certain things. It's a sort of denial that takes over.
I have a feeling that she thought it would be a good marriage if she coached herself.
Yes, I think that, yes, I think that's true. I think she thought she'd be changing. And how many people, perhaps in this room, have set out with the same fortitude and optimism of heart?
It was a huge deception on her.
Huge.
So it wasn't a normal marriage.
No, it was a very particular marriage. And in fact,
so it's hard to compare them to marriage. So I think it set their marriage apart again.
Well, I think, you know, as Tolstoy wrote about unhappy families, each family is unhappy in its own particular way, and so is each marriage. In its own particular way. And their marriage, as you say, was a very particular marriage.
Now, this is becoming a bit like a book club here.
And you've given away the plot! The rest of the plot! That's all right, I forgive you.
We'll take that off the podcast. Yeah. I hope you haven't finished it.
So.
Other book. Go on, yeah.
Australia's family laws are changing to have property rights.
There's
a
bust-up. The arguments over property.
Well,
yeah.
You've got, let's say, a legal marriage.
Oh, goodness me.
Oh.
It's so complicated.
I mean, you get half the golf clubs.
Or the whole golf club. I don't know. I mean, it is just a sign of how complex things have become, and that's one of the other pressures on modern marriages, that people are having to deal with so many permutations of relationships, biological, you know, social. I mean, if you just look at Stephen Conroy's conception of that child, there was a woman who donated the egg, a woman who carried the egg, or the fetus, and then the mother who's raising the child. I mean, how complicated is that? In splitting up the ties, the biological and nurturing ties that somebody has with a child. We just live in such a complex thought world. That's an interesting question. That's a good a topic for a feature article on this.
There's someone I missed down here. Yes. I missed
it. What would you say are the two or three things that would make marriage strong?
Well, they always say that the minute you roll your eyes, the contempt is a really poisonous.
This is not a good sign.
And communication, absolutely, definitely. You know, being able to adapt, whatever life dumps in your lap, and good sex, I think, really glues marriage together. You know, that those three things are critical. And in fact, I had written a story before the launch of the book describing, in the words of counsellors, what were the strengths of a good marriage, and someone who was addressing a management seminar gave up, stood up and quoted these things, but I think that as the points in a good workplace, but I think they left out the good sex. But I think it's contempt, scorn, and you know, disappointment, anger bubbling away under the surface too long is very corrosive in a marriage. But that said, mine seems to have withstood all of those things. Touch wood. Don't know what's happening at home tonight.
It's pretty disturbing. We've been married for 38 years and Anne's been rolling her eyes before.
Sent me an email that she had had finished my book during a delightful solo weekend, one of the joys of an age. I don't know what else was going on, but I can definitely say that's what she was doing.
Well, solo weekend, of course. look, we're getting towards the end now. Richard.
Okay. You work for The Australian, and it's very interesting to hear a journalist talking as a novelist in the way in which you have tonight. But I'm just wondering if you could tell us just a little bit about working on The Australian at the moment, because it seems quite extraordinary that this newspaper is so much livelier. It's got a future, it's got growing circulation, unlike the Pravda on the Yarra, as I think it is down there, and other newspapers. But it seems to be going in the opposite direction to much of the newspapers in the world. And as a journalist working on the newspaper, I'd just be interested to hear how you feel about somehow going against the trend and being part of what must be a very exciting place to work these days.
Well, I wouldn't beat it up too much. But I was one of the very early defectors to The Australian, where most of my colleagues, because I worked for the Fairfax Press initially, and, you know, I was regarded as a blackguard and a scapegoat and a scab. And, you know, the thing about, I was just talking about this with my colleague Andrew Manning today, about Murdoch, is that he's passionate about the product. He's one of the few proprietors, you know, in control today, who absolutely adores the media. I mean, it's his passion. You know, he reads papers constantly. And that's what's the problem, or that has been the problem, I fear, with Fairfax, is that they've had people at the helm who really haven't understood the business that they're in. And Murdoch was reported as saying the other day that we're going to start looking at getting subscribers to pay for information online. Because, I mean, newspapers are on the way out. I fear they are absolutely dying. I always used to joke that, you know, I'd be telling my grandchildren, they'd say to me, "Grandma, what's a newspaper?" Mm-hmm. And that day, I haven't even got the grandchildren yet, and sadly, I can see it coming all too quickly. And I think one of the great stories that newspapers have failed to cover is the story of their own demise. And again, I was talking to one of my colleagues, Gary Hughes, who was responsible for setting up the online site of The Age, and the hair-raising, the stories of seeing editors who just didn't understand the power of the internet and the power of electronics to really cannibalise them. And, you know, we've really sort of been responsible in a way. We've let that happen. We haven't covered it and we haven't dealt with it. And we're making a sort of last minute ditch to the finish line to try and salvage and protect and give some premium to the gathering of information, the prioritising of stories. Because at the moment there's a plethora of information out there on the internet, and what you've got to have is the sifting and the digging and the investigation that journalists still do so well. So look, I'm very glad I'm there, in the sense that at least, you know, we've made, I think, a 700, I can't remember the size of the profit. It was a loss in the last figures. But, you know, he cross-subsidises, of course, with all of the other parts of his empire. But, you know, he's a man, thank God, who passionately loves journalism.
Okay,
sorry, but presumably if Rupert Murdoch doesn't live to 100 as he's threatened, the demise will be earlier.
Well, that's right. That, again, where I was talking with Andrew Mann about Kerry Packer. I mean, Kerry Packer died, and James went into casinos. Just didn't have any deal for it in the same way that Kerry did. And, yes, who knows what happened. I mean, there'd be an almighty blue, first of all, between the family members for the share of the fortune.
Well, I think we've moved from fiction to non-fiction. I think that's a good spot to end. So, this turn over there for a second, I'll be very, very quick. As I said, Jenna Grundy's got copies of The Marriage Club outside. As we learned last time when Kate spoke here, Kate's great fun. She always says she's nervous and she's not a great public speaker. But in fact, she's great fun, and it was an entertaining talk again tonight, and congratulations on your second novel. And you didn't, we didn't give it all away, although some people tried. There's still a plot, and no doubt you'll write a third novel or more non-fiction. What's your next?
Number three novel.
So well done tonight, and many thanks. Well done. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.